Hi, my name is Matthias Biniok, and I'm optimistic that European and German companies will leverage AI systems at scale to regain their competitive advantages in the global economy.
The Optimist. Conversations with leaders and industries shaping Europe's future. Exploring the ideas and innovations driving progress across the continent.
Welcome to The Optimist, presented to you by Tech by Handelsblatt. I'm Felix Zeltner, your host, and I have the honor today to take you into sovereign AI. What is sovereign AI? How far are we in Europe with sovereign AI? Why does sovereign AI fail in so many places again, again, and again? All of this and more, I have the honor to speak with Matthias Biniok, who leads client engineering in Germany, Austria, and Switzerland at IBM. Now, IBM has been around in Europe for a long time, and Matthias has been in AI for a long time. He started out sending a robot to space, to an international space station. It's floating around there. Astronauts can talk to it. That was years ago. And in between, he turned from a computer scientist into an AI expert. And he's now helping public and private institutions to improve their business processes. Together with his team, they automate, they use AI in the right places. And he talks about how tricky that is. And he talks about why Europe has a chance to catch up with AI, not maybe when it comes to building the fastest and smartest software, but by adopting, by learning, and by being lean and within the rules and regulations on the continent. A fascinating person to have some real AI talk with, Matthias Biniok. Welcome.
Thank you. How are you?
Good. Thank you. It's great to have you on. And Matthias, one of your early projects, I learned, was Simon, or how do you pronounce it? Simon?
Simon, yeah.
Simon. Simon is, it's such a cute name, a robot floating in space. I think a robot assistant would be the correct term, on the ISS, International Space Station. What did you learn building a floating space robot that, of course, also works with artificial intelligence when it comes to helping me understand what AI really is versus what is being hyped right now? Yeah. I'm really trying, maybe we can use Simon as a little helper to help us what you learned earlier in your career about what AI really is and how it can really lead to physical things that help us do things in space or on Earth.
Yeah. It's a great question. And so Simon is abbreviation for Crew Interactive Mobile Companion. So it's basically a companion for the astronauts, for the crew up there. And that was almost 10 years ago, right? So it was a different time then. If you think back, there was no attention is all you need paper out yet, right? There's no large language model, no ChatGPT, no nothing. And it was really classical machine learning and natural language processing. So quite an interesting
time. The good olden days.
Yeah, the good, yeah, exactly. And we worked together with Airbus Defence and Space and the German Space Agency, the LMU Klinikum, Biotest Luzern and other partners to build this robot. It looks like a basketball floating in the International Space Station. It has a face and a screen. And it can talk to astronauts and helps them with their daily tasks, right? And this is what we built, and we started very early. And one thing that I learned that is still valid today in AI projects is iterate fast. So see what's working, look at what's not working or what's not yet working, right? And then also listen to user feedback. I have a few funny stories from there, but one thing that comes to my mind always is like the question about the face. And we asked the astronauts, how do you want the face to look like, right? And the astronaut was like, I don't care at all, right? So make that thing work. That's the only thing I care about, right? So these are the kind of things that you need to listen to, of course. And one other interesting fact is that the AI functionality it needs to fit the situation. And this is also something that's still valid, right? So for example, in this setting, when Simon was in kind of an experiment mode and supporting the astronauts, he was super straightforward, super clear, and very short answers only, and very straightforward. And then, of course, there were like small talk moments, and he was funny and sometimes even making jokes or being a little bit ironic. And you need to fit this situation. And this is something that that is true also for today's AI.
You're a builder. You have all the engineering knowledge, but you went into sales leadership right now. So when you're selling AI now to large enterprises through IBM, compared to back in the days where IBM Watson, and there was all this hype around like the very early stages of AI getting out into the world. Today, we're talking about AI agents. We had an entire podcast episode about that. So what has changed for you when you pitch AI to people compared to when you started out in this field 10, 15 years ago?
The technology has changed fundamentally. So for example, let's focus on natural language processing. If you look at classical natural language processing 10 years ago, that was proper engineering, I would say, right? So you would need to understand the linguistics. There's a lot of input from computational linguistics that went into these models. And then still the output could have been good, but sometimes it was also not good and you didn't know why, all right? So this has changed now with large language models. They have seen so much data that they are extremely good at predicting next words and basically generating content or extracting content from data that you give to them. And this is something that has changed in terms of large language models.
So 10 years ago, I love that you said proper engineering. I think there's the computer scientists in you is coming through and the German saying, this was proper engineering. Today, they're just like prompting something, another AI tool, and then getting their code out of it.
But to be honest, the proper engineering is still happening, right? It's just at another place right now. These models are super big and they are multi-purpose and you can use them much more easy. And before that, you had to build your own model and a separate model for each different use case. And that's the big change here. So there's still engineering happening, but not so much as before, I would say.
And you're also saying that back in the days when you started out in this field, there were that the fact that you could even sell something that was called artificial intelligence was already so new, so novel, that that was the product. And today, with an agentic system, you're not only selling that, you're selling decision-making tool. And you're selling something that is taking over or somebody delegates actions to. We had a brief conversation before recording the podcast, and you told me a number that I found staggering. You said like 80% of companies fail right now when they try to work with AI agents.
Yeah.
So what is going wrong?
Yeah, the question is, what does failure mean, right? So failure, in my opinion, means it's not getting into production, right? You try something out and it's not working. It's not working the way you expect it to work. In preparation, I even looked it up if this number is correct, right? And I found another number,
okay.
85%. Forbes says 85% of your AI models fail.
And doesn't make it better.
It doesn't make it better, no. So I think the numbers are actually in that range. And there are a few things that I see. The biggest thing that I see is really scaling agentic AI systems or scaling AI systems in general beyond the pilot phase, and then getting the right ROI, the right return on investment, the expected business value. And this is something that is oftentimes not working in the way that the enterprise wanted. And it always starts, or it typically starts, with the data not being available. I don't know how many projects already failed before they were started just because the data was not available. You need to understand, okay, what's the data governance? How do I get access? How do I have the right security? Then you need the right data quality for it. Then you need the lineage because you want to be compliant with AI Act and whatever, right? And you want to also share the data and make sure that not only you have access to the data, but maybe also other departments. And this kind of overall data infrastructure, that's something that I see missing in many, many clients. And then as soon as you have something that is working, you have figured out a data part, you have built your model, right? Then you need to think about monitoring. the models right now, they change so fast. There are new models coming out every day. So the question is, how do you keep up with that? How do you do the model monitoring? How do you create prompt templates around that? Observability and risk management is a big topic there. So there are so many things you need to think about that could potentially, if you don't have the right platform, don't have the right approach, that could potentially destroy your return on investment and also hinder you from actually reaching the scale that you want to do. And that's also one of the reasons why my team always starts with a business value assessment. In every pilot, everything that we do, we start with a business value assessment, and then we are iterating over the pilot.
What does that mean?
It's basically, for example, ROI calculation, right? So we try to understand what are the amount of end users using the system, how much time do they spend with their current approach, what time would be spent with the new solution, what would it cost to bring it into production? What are the license costs, for example, and all the other things? And then based on that, we can figure out, does it make sense to implement it? And if it's not making sense, then that's fine as well, because it could mean we need another use case to make sure that that we actually need an AI platform, for example, in the enterprise.
It almost reminds me like when you are trying to get an agent to work in your company, you're onboarding a whole new team or you're acquiring a company and you have to make sure that your data aligns with this new addition, that you use the right words with them, that everybody knows what they're working with. Everybody needs to get educated and trained on this new addition. So it's a lot that you have to put into.
Exactly.
Before there's anything coming back.
Yeah.
Of value. I feel like, at least in the conversations that I've been following, that's very underestimated or under communicated sometimes. And you said in the very beginning of our conversation that you're optimistic about the Europeans, the Germans, leveraging AI systems at scale, regain competitive advantages in the global economy. Like, really strong statement. So I wanted to go from the insights on AI, which I thought were fascinating, thank you for that, to what you think about the Europeans and the Germans at this point. I would say it's probably becoming or already a buzzword, digital sovereignty in Europe. On a scale from 1, not sovereign, very dependent, to 10, very sovereign, very independent, how sovereign are we at this point in Europe? What kind of grade would you give us Europeans at this point?
As a good IT consultant, I have to say it depends, right?
So don't give me a 5. Come on.
No, it really depends on how you define the sovereignty, right? So because if you are talking about IT sovereignty, for example, right? So I know quite a few large companies that are very sovereign and they have on-premise IT computing resources. All their data is on-premise. For non-critical workload, they have public cloud that they're relying on, especially in the banking sector, in the public sector. And these companies, they're looking for like modernization of their IT estate, but also looking at the innovation promise that comes with these hyperscalers, for example, or other IT providers. And I think in terms of that IT sovereignty, we're quite good, right? So we know how to do that in Germany. We know how to put everything on premise, what we need to do on premise. And I would rank us in the upper levels there.
Okay. So just to clarify, this is about where the data is. You're saying we're pretty good.
Where the data is and where the compute is. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
But when it comes to AI sovereignty, that's a different thing because, of course, we are relying heavily on large language models that are not from Europe, not from Germany even, right? So it's something that is being built and trained in other markets and other regions of the world. And I'm not sure if we are already being very sovereign in the AI world. It also depends on GPU resources that we have available. And this is, in my opinion, a bigger issue, but it is still possible. And I have one example that I would like to share with you, and it's a company called ABP in Austria. Yeah? And ABP is like a big patent company, and they are not only lawyers, but they're also providing digital patent services, right? And they wanted to be the number one digital patent service provider, and they wanted to do it as intelligent as possible. So we partnered with them, And they said, you know what? I want to put all patents in the world into my vector database and make them searchable to make sure that we can react super fast on these kind of patent requests that are coming from companies or whomever, right? And they actually did it. And it was quite a big work of engineering, but they didn't do it because patent, as you know, it's a very, very secure topic and it's something that you need to do in your own data center if possible. So they said, we don't have a big data center, but we want to do it in our own house or in our own area if possible. So they actually bought an overall system from IBM with GPUs inside, with the computational power inside, with the storage inside that is able then to do all these indexing and putting all the information to the vector databases so that they now can search it. And this has already been completed and is already being sold by the company to their clients. So they did it in a completely sovereign way. So my point of view is that if you have these kind of use cases, you not necessarily need this kind of super huge data centers everywhere, but you can even do it on a smaller scale if you have the right use cases identified and work on these use cases. So we do have a problem, but it's not something that I would say is not is unsolvable.
So to the question I'd ask you to rate our digital sovereignty in Europe between 1 and 10, you're saying when it comes to where the data sits and where the computers, the servers are that people use, we're more between a 5 and a 10. When it comes to the software or the AI that we're using on those servers, more between a 1 and a 5 still. I'm trying to understand what exactly sovereign AI would actually mean, because you're saying when you look at the language models that we are using right now, they're usually not from where we are. We get them from someplace else. So what is actually the problem of sovereign AI in Europe? Like, why is there not many, many more companies building language models? It can't be only the fact that we have so many languages in Europe. There has to be another reason, right?
No, it could be even an advantage, right? But coming to the fact, okay, what is sovereign AI? I think that's important that we kind of define that, right? And As I said, there are different aspects, but overall, it's kind of you're aligning an AI system with companies or a nation's interest, right? And this can be strategic interest, legal, economic, ethical, whatever. And with that, you're ensuring this autonomy and this sovereignty in these AI applications or capabilities without relying on any other foreign entities or other entities that you can't control, like entities for infrastructure, data, or models. Yeah? And I think this is really important, infrastructure, data, or models. We sometimes have the infrastructure available, for example, for fine-tuning our own models with our own GPUs, right? Do we have the data sovereignty? Do we have the right data? Do we know how the models have been trained with? Is it something that we have done? Probably not in most cases, that we can see or control. In some cases, if it's really open source, you can do it, right? Or something that is completely closed source and you cannot look into it, right? So this is kind of the data behind that. And then, of course, the model itself. Is it something that is just Apache 2.0 or any other very open source? So you have the infrastructure side of the sovereignty. Where does it run? Where has it been trained? The data, with what kind of data has it been trained? And then the model itself, who owns it and who can change it and what's the license behind it? And with all of these aspects, you need to ask yourself a few questions. So can I move that system that I run right now to another system, for example, right? So I have my AI application on the cloud. Can I move it to a different cloud? Or can I move it to on-premise if needed? Or am I completely stuck in this environment, right? How much effort is it to do it, to move that? And can I run my current software stack that I use? Can I run it on a different hardware? For example, because I don't get the hardware from any other country anymore, right? am I up to date with the latest and greatest models, or do I have to rely on not so good models from Europe because I say this is something that I only rely on only European models? These are the kind of questions that you have to ask yourself if you want to define, am I really sovereign as a company?
So fascinating. I mean, I was just thinking about the fact that I am somebody who professionally learned how to create content. And when ChatGPT came with its big explosion into our world 2.5 years ago, we learned that somebody broke into our house, everybody who creates content, whether it's film, words, audio, or even architecture, took all our stuff and then rang the doorbell a few days later and was like, oh, I'm so sorry. I didn't know you had a door. But, you know, I can't really give you back what I took, but maybe I can give you a little bit of money. And it was a really weird situation, I think, for everybody who is working with IP to learn that a system had taken everything and is now super smart, super strong, and will maybe be smarter than all of us forever. Now, you're saying that the Europeans have a chance to build a system that is within the laws and the regulations of Europe and that follows the rules, that is transparent, you said, where you know where the words, the wisdom, everything is taken from. So do you even think that the rules, the regulations, the bureaucracy that we all love to complain about endlessly could be an ally in making European AI the winner in the end? Because it's the only system that follows the rules and respects who owns what?
I'm not sure about being a winner in the end. I think we need to work together as global companies. But I do think that bureaucracy can be an ally in some cases, right? So let's say we implement a system in the public sector, right? And this is something that we've already done a few times. And what I learned by working with the public sector very closely is that the best way how you make sure to eventually also sell it to the client and that you eventually make sure that it comes into production is by fulfilling all these requirements, by fulfilling all these regulations. And then at the same time, our own approaches that we said, we want to do it very fast and we want to do it client-centric. And if you think about it, fulfilling all these different processes and then at the same time being super client-centric, it's not really a balance, right? So it's not secure that we can make it work. But I have one client where we made it work, and this is the Landratsamt Augsburg. It's basically, and one part of this is, yeah, it's a beautiful word. It's the youth welfare office, basically, right, of this municipal organization of Germany.
Okay.
And
kind of a local government agency, you could say.
Exactly, yeah. And they are tasked with the support or and protection of children, but also supporting them with, for example, money if they don't have the right resources. And what they do is basically they bring in documents, let's say a report about a smartphone contract or something like that. And then the officers in this organization, they need to decide, is that legal? Is that correct that we can pay for this smartphone bill, for example? And they have actually people that are working on exactly these tasks day by day, right? And they try to look in all these different sources. They will understand how does the smartphone bill look like and so on. They look at the individual and then in the end they decide. And this was a painful amount of time that they spent on that, really hours every day, sometimes only on one document. And this is what we also automated, right? To understand, okay, here's the bill, here are the laws, here's the information about the individual. How can we combine that and make sure that we get a recommendation, right? A recommendation where the responsible people then can say, you know what, I'm going to pay that bill now and I'm going to approve that request, for example. And this has been very successfully launched in a pilot. And now, of course, we're trying to put it also into production. And those are the kind of things where we use all these different processes and we make sure that we align with them, that we comply with them.
And you also work with judges, with courts, where there's very sensitive data. And you're saying the value of a European sovereign AI, of something that's built on the ground, on the continent, follows all the rules and regulations, is trust. that you have the public sector and other very sensitive places trusted more. And I find the ironic tweak here is that you, of course, work for IBM.
Yeah.
And I wonder how you bridge that gap in, let's say, sovereign trust. So how does it work for IBM to be digitally European, digitally sovereign? How do you make that work? How do you explain it if I was someone who is interested in your technology?
Yeah. So of course that's a question that we hear quite often. And the thing that I'm also very proud of is that, first of all, IBM has a long history here in Germany. I think 115 years or something like that already now. So a very, very old and trusted company for the whole region. And we have basically three main things that we focus on in our technology. First of all is this openness, this flexibility, right? So we are built upon open source. So our technology is built on open source. We're using open source models. We have our own models as well that are open source, by the way. And we are also integrating with third-party models that must not be, or that can be not open source, but we still integrate with them. We can run the whole thing locally, air-gapped. So if you work with secure organizations then or internal agencies here, this has to be air-gapped and completely secure on-premise. And we can scale that with an open platform to connect to various data sources. So it's all on-premise and we are very open about it. That's the first thing. Then sovereignty, we talked about it. Data sovereignty, you own the data. Only the things that you put in there will be in your system. IBM cannot look at the system anymore, right? You own the models, you can change the models, you can build your own models, and the infrastructure, you're super flexible with the infrastructure as well, either on the cloud or on-premise as needed. You can integrate it into your own system. So this is kind of the sovereignty that you need. And then last but not least, and I think this is particularly true for Europe, you need to make sure that you are compliant and that you have a focus on data security. And you need to think security really at the core, including like quantum safe approaches. You have risk management embedded at all these different levels, from data to the models, to the application in production. And all of that needs to run on kind of this open, flexible, hybrid cloud approach so that you can actually move from one cloud to another without having that problem. That's the approach that IBM takes. And that's also one of the reasons why many organizations in the public sector or also in the banking industry trust IBM that much, also here in Europe, because they say, yeah, we can put the whole thing on premise. There's no kill switch or whatever, right? We are in full control of the entire system. Of course, we are worried about it and we see these geopolitical issues, but it's not something that we are completely scared of because we have this right solution for it.
Yeah, it's easy to forget, of course, how long IBM has been around. You're over 100 years old. I think you started out with punch cards and measuring systems. And I think that the trust that you just talked about also stems from that long time that you have been engaged on the continent. And it probably gives you a competitive edge over startups or other companies that are maybe 5 or 10 years old. So it's really interesting to hear how you're in this day and age where things are moving so quickly and tech seems to be a new thing, that you're actually a legacy company and that the legacy is one of your advantages. And I'm so grateful that you're taking the time today, Matthias, to be here. Before you head off to your next client meetings, I'm just wondering two things. First of all, do you have any agent in your life right now that is really helping you? Any AI tool that is, you know, making your daily life easier that you can share with us?
Yeah, definitely. I have a few, actually. I have one agent to keep up with the trends in AI. I have one agent that regularly scans the different AI websites, crawls them, then puts together a summary, puts them to a PowerPoint presentation in the format that I like, and then just creates that for me. And as soon as I have it, I can use it in my presentations, or I can just read through it regularly. That's something that I use. I've written it.
Hold on a second. So AI websites, you're saying all the competitors of IBM? Is that what you're crawling?
For example, yeah, or newsletter websites or whatever, right?
And then you have an AI tool that creates PowerPoint presentations?
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
Did you code it yourself?
That's coded by myself, yeah. Of course, using IBM technology, yeah, but it's coded by myself, yeah.
Oh, I wish I had that. Okay, so that is basically helping you kind of putting a trend report out.
Yeah.
So you have a trend agent that's like constantly running in the background. You don't have to read through gazillions of newsletters doing it for you. Amazing.
Exactly, yeah. And okay. Also, I have one tool that is scanning all the different projects that we're doing in our CRM system, right? So it's just crawling the CRM system, then getting updates, status updates from it. So for example, if a project has been moving from a co-creation to a completed stage and then just sending me a notification about it with some information, what that project was about, because I have to track like hundreds of projects right now, and I wouldn't be able to do it manually. So I have my little AI agent doing it for me.
That you also coded yourself?
I had a little help there, it's working and it's in production basically, yeah.
Sometimes I wish I was a computer scientist. Matthias, last question. When you think about the next 10, 15 years, basically the same time span you have now spent with artificial intelligence, with coding yourself, with building systems, with IBM, what do you wish you had a trend line on today when it comes to taking this next time span into the future? What do you wish you would know today how it's evolving?
So one thing that I would wish to have a trend line on, and maybe another thing that I'm worried about, is the human and AI collaboration, right? I'm seeing a social gap coming and a capability gap coming, especially if you look at kind of this automation bias, what is happening right now. So if you rely on machines making decisions, mm-hmm. or recommending decisions, recommending actions, and the actions are good, you're getting biased, right? Because you trust the AI system. And this is something that we are not much aware of yet. So this is something that we need to work on. And also there's kind of a de-skilling problem coming, that a lot of things will be getting lost over time, because we don't need to do them, because the AI can do it for us. And there will be this social gap and capability gap in the society of the future. And we need to work against it, right? We need to find solutions about that. We need to find new ways how to learn, new ways how to collaborate with AI, new ways also how to review results from an AI. And this is something what I would like to see more. And for the trend line, I would love to see kind of AI capability versus AI adoption, maybe per region or per country. So who has the most capability, who has the most infrastructure, data available, GPUs available, etc., versus which countries are adopting it. So which countries are actually using AI in the most effective way, all right? And this is something where I see Europe as a continent that can be leading. Maybe not in the capability, because China and US, they have quite a head start there. We can catch up. But I think in adoption, if I look at all these big companies and great companies here in Europe, I think we are in a good shape if we now make the right moves. And that's what I'm working for, to make sure that we have that right AI adoption in Europe and in Germany.
So what gives you hope is that while we didn't start as much speed as other continent in Europe when it comes to this new technology, we are learning it and we are using it and we are getting smart with it quicker than others. And that might enable us to catch up on the other side and start building systems and maybe even the hardware or the computational power that is smarter than what is being built right now, where it's just about bigger, bigger, bigger. Did I understand that correctly?
Yeah, correct.
I just heard at the tech conference in Heilbronn, actually, from space startups who said, yeah, we're here in Europe. And of course, when you look at other continents, like the US, you see space, this huge, massive industry and billions of dollars. But we also are building rockets that can land again. And we're also creating a constant stream of people and goods going to space and back, but we're building it at a fraction of the cost. Yeah. And that exactly. might be our USP. So you're saying that could be applied to AI and other technological fields as well?
Definitely. And sometimes these limitations that you have, or maybe the setback that you have, can also be an inspiration for creativity and new solutions. And I hope for that, and I'm very confident that we can also make a good move on that as Europe and Germany.
And I hope I can at some point use your PowerPoint AI. I'm really jealous. Thank you, Matthias, for being on The Optimist today. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you very much, Felix. Thanks.
Thanks for listening to The Optimist. For more insights and updates about tech, visit us at tech-europe.org. The Optimist is produced by Tech by Handelsblatt. Music by Christian Heinemann. Stay curious.